You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, my guest is Grace Shearson. Grace is the author of a wonderful new book, Zen Women, Beyond Tea Ladies, Iron Maidens, and Macho Masters. Grace is a clinical psychologist specializing in women and families, as well as an ordained Zen abbess and a Dharma teacher in the Suzuki Roshi lineage. She has been married for 41 years, has two grown sons and four grandchildren. She lives at her Zen retreat center in the Sierra foothills. So let's welcome Grace to the show now. Hi, Grace. How are you?
I'm very well. And you?
Are you delighted? Well? I'm fine. I'm in a very upbeat mood today.
In the middle of your weekend.
Yes. Well, it does kind of, the high point of the weekend, I guess. I just want to say that I loved your book and the detailed accounts of the women who were clearly standing in their own power in a time when it wasn't encouraged.
Yes, isn't that wonderful, the examples?
Yes, it really is. And we're going to get into more about how you dug that up and where it came from. And, you know, it does seem that when we investigate into our past, it appears that the feminine aspect or the females, the women, have been written out of history, especially with spirituality. What prompted you to write this book, and where did you begin your research?
Well, what prompted me to write the book was one of the women at the Berkeley Zen Center where I practiced asking why there were no images of women. It came as a surprise because we'd all been looking at that for 20 or 30 years in the Zen Center, but we hadn't thought to ask and even to consider it. So immediately I started looking around when I made a trip to Japan, and I found little images. But as I entered the practice more deeply and became ordained as a priest, I realized I didn't know how to embody the role of priest. You know, we choose our professions by role models, and I didn't really have any role models in the history of Zen for the work I was taking on. And so I felt that I needed to begin the research. And the first time I went to a woman's temple in Japan, which is where I did most of my research, I heard the sound of women's voices chanting, and it was so different than the low drone of Buddhist chanting. There's something so sweet and warm about it. So I knew that I hit the jackpot, that there actually was something versus just nothing, and that I would find something.
Wow. Well, it sounds like you found a gold mine there.
It didn't occur to me that other women would be interested. This was just something I needed to know for myself. But at one point, I was invited to a conference on female ancestors, and there were several scholars there who were invited to talk about their translation work, and I realized that there were women who were translating the female masters from China and Japan. And now, because of our feminism in the West, we now had women scholars who were doing this research in Chinese and Japanese, and so this was unfolding before our very eyes.
Wow. It sounds as if, as you write in your book, that the female Zen ancestors had been erased from the official accounts, that some of these scholars were able to translate from other countries accounts that had been heretofore not translated and made available.
Right. That they were, you know, sort of like the women's NBA league. They were considered not as important as the male league.
Huh.
So it's very interesting, too, the parallels in this country, because all the female scholars I know who began studying or trying to find the trail of the female ancestors were told by their mentors and their superiors in the academic world that they should give up this silly work and look for the great male masters, that they should use their translation skills to translate the great male Zen masters and leave the silly work of translating the women Zen masters alone.
Wow. Were there any that you found, of course there are some that you found that were equal to or even greater perhaps in their teaching abilities and their uniqueness in teaching their students? Do you have stories of, because we've all heard the story about the Zen master that smacks the student with a bamboo stick and he falls out of the window and breaks his legs and things.
Yeah, but that generally didn't go over well if women did it. So,
no.
So usually their teaching methods were broader. I don't mean to make a pun, but they had many more teaching methods.
Yeah.
Had many more teaching methods, and they were very, most of the teachers, the female teachers that made a big impression were very clever with words.
Oh.
So I don't know if you've ever seen the book Woman's Word. It also is Woman's Sword. The fact is that women, although we're not physically as strong as men, we all know that,
right,
have a different kind of strength, both in our ability to endure discomfort and pain and in our ability to speak. And so this was, I think, really a high point of some of the women teachers. Now, there was one woman teacher that I had never seen translated into English before that I found a scholar to help me translate for the first time. And she lived in the 17th century in Japan. And she was as powerful during her day as the prime minister of Japan was during his day. So she was the spiritual advisor to the shogun. Now, when I even tracked down that she still had a temple that existed today, Saishoji in Tokyo, her name is Soshini, when I conjectured with one of the Japanese scholars as to why she had been erased, he tended to agree with me. You know, the Zen masters are powerful images as cowboys, and they're kind of conquerors, and they themselves are unconquered. On the other hand, Soshini, who had a very powerful spiritual teaching and was very powerful during her day, had a story of being divorced by her husband. Maybe this had to do with the father having Christianity in his background and the shogun ruling that if you'd had Christianity, had the belief of Christianity in your background, which your father did, you would be shunned in some way by the aristocracy. So she was divorced, she lost her husband, and then her second husband, and this is pretty unusual for a 17th century Japan to be divorced, very shaming. And her second husband lost his wealth and was reduced to poverty. So, you know, these women who were married and belong to men and were cast off, there's a certain kind of shame on them. Some of them were actually concubines. And because of this double standard of women who've sort of been conquered sexually or in some way tainted by the world, they don't have that same flavor of being the conqueror that the Zen masters do. And that's a very powerful image. It really lines up with the Western image of the cowboy.
Interesting. Interesting. And, of course, the women would have the intuitive side developed more intimately, and the male would probably have to work on that to gain the right-brained insights that the women had and just automatically.
And, of course, doing meditation, and, of course, some men are gifted intuitively. So I would say some of the spiritual leaders on the male side combined the intuitive abilities and great strength and power and charisma. Mm-hmm. On the female side, what we see is a kind of strength, an enduring kind of courage, not the kind of strength that, you know, smites the whole army, but a kind of strength that can endure a lot of suffering, and a kind of perseverance, and a kind of ability to find her way even when she was swimming against the stream. So this kind of woman actually has a kind of leadership that we don't yet have a name for. Mm. We like the intuitive and supportive strong male leader, which we generally call the strong silent type. But when we look to the female side of things, what do we say about a female leader? What that compares to this kind of strength and silence that we see, that we say, oh, this is the strong silent type in men. Those are the kind of Zen leaders even today that we select. It is hard for people to understand that a sort of tough as nails and intuitive, very strong female, what do we call that kind of leadership? Mm. I don't know that we have a name for it.
Yeah.
I think we call it the B word generally.
Yes, that's true. That's true. It has a negative connotation. Well, now you mentioned perseverance and sacrifice, and I know that there were pioneering nuns who made extraordinary sacrifices, according to your book, including disfiguring themselves just for the privilege of studying with their male masters. What kind of disfigurement would they do, and why would that be gain favor with the masters?
Well, one of the things that we see historically in all of the different traditions, I've seen it in Catholicism and Taoism as well, I don't know so much about the other traditions, and in Buddhism in several cases, where women have to convince their family or someone that they are not desirable as a sexual object, and that they have themselves transcended the use of seduction and beauty as a means to power, and that they are willing to move beyond that. Mm. So in the case of Buddhist women, the Buddha himself had determined that he wanted men and women to practice in separate practice places. In the case of some of the women in Japan, it's kind of like separate but equal in the United States. Yes, they should have separate but equal places to practice, but there weren't any convents, and there weren't any substantial teachers for them. So these women who wanted to get to the bottom of what did life mean and really wanted to apply themselves to a Zen practice would have to go to a monastery. In some cases, they were refused by the guiding teacher of that monastery, and so in a couple of cases, they took a hot iron to their faces and then reapplied, showing the teacher, I can't change the fact that I'm a woman, but I want you to know that using my feminine wiles is not an option for me, and I'm not why I'm... So they could not transcend the fact that they were women, but they could transcend the stereotypes that people had about women as a seductress.
Interesting. Interesting. And, of course, the men didn't have to do that with their prowess and their ability to rape and pillage. That was all right and acceptable.
Well, it wasn't acceptable once they took on the Buddhist precepts, but those kinds of qualities, those samurai kinds of qualities, were not considered a flaw, which is so much the better for women. In a certain way, they had to be enlightened before they could even enter training. I said to my own teacher in Japan that I felt that it was not doing men a service to allow the male monks to have a priority treatment to the female practitioners at the temple that I was practicing at, because after all, we had derived so much benefit from being discriminated against. We had really learned how to practice anyway, and men should have that opportunity too. It would be good for them.
Yes, yes.
We were getting all the good spiritual training, and they were missing some of the great opportunities that we had.
Wow. Now, when you studied in Japan, did you study mainly or solely under male masters?
Well, I did make a short visit to practice with a female master, but it wasn't really a match to my training needs. So I did practice almost entirely. I practiced in three temples for a little bit longer times, and all three temples were led by men and were male training monasteries.
Ah. Now, when you choose to take that path towards enlightenment or towards your own spiritual development, what is required of you? I've seen so many stories, the Hollywood versions, and I've read certain books about it, but there are so many hours per day of meditation, as I understand it, and study, and what else? What would you have to do to acquire the, you know, to acquire
the knowledge? To enter a training monastery?
Yes.
Well, I think that, you know, we have a version, our own version in the West now of training places, and I myself have a retreat center where people can come and train. And so we ask people to enter just where they are and see how it appeals to them. But sooner or later, they recognize that what you're doing in terms of finding how to develop your spiritual consciousness, you're undoing when you're thinking and in engaging yourself in ego games throughout the day. So some concentrated effort to overturn that energy is required. And so this is why they have long periods of practice. It's like being in the ocean. If you get knocked down by one wave, you can get right back up and go about your business. And it's the same with your ego. If you get knocked down by one wave of meditation right after you walk out the door, your ego will pick itself right up and start in again.
Yeah.
If you are knocked down by wave after wave after wave, the ego kind of sinks to the bottom. So the particular training temple I went to in Japan, where I could do week-long retreats with the men. I couldn't live there because it was a male training monastery, but I could stay with them for about a week. In that temple, we got up at 3 in the morning and started meditating.
Ooh.
So that means I got up at 2:30 to get myself together and be kind of in a daze at 3 a.m., and then we would stay up throughout the day till about 11 at night to continue.
Wow, that is quite a discipline. That in itself would lead to something, I'm sure. Just the sheer nature of the unusualness of the, you know, the hours and what you were doing.
Yeah, it's the same in the Catholic, you know, Catholic tradition. They wake you up for your prayers at certain hours of the day, and so you know, the fact that your sleep is disrupted throws off your whole mental functioning, and you just can't put yourself together with the same level of defensiveness and organization. And as you start to fall apart a little, if you don't go crazy, you find another source of awareness that isn't in that organized cognitive space. Mm. So that's what they're aiming for. But actually, the hardest thing for me was not... I'm pretty good with sleep deprivation, so that wasn't the worst thing for me. Although I must say, for the first few hours of the day when I would, when this would go on for a week, from, let's say, between 3 and 6, I felt like I was dead. And I was just a walking dead person. But the hardest thing for me was the customs that they use in the male training temples, which is a lot of beatings. And,
oh, really?
Yeah, they still use a stick, which they hit the monks on their shoulders with. And so for the new monks, it's quite the hazing process.
Oh, wow.
And they would get 4 hits per shoulder, four hits per each shoulder, maybe 6 times an hour for 15 or hours a day. So you could imagine that they lost some skin fairly quickly in that process.
And
it was very, very hard for me to sit and do meditation through that brutality. So what I came to, and that was the hardest part for me.
Yeah.
So what I came to deal with was, okay, I think there's something in this training that I need to get to, which was training with this great Zen master. Unfortunately, I do not understand this cultural aspect, which is the hitting. So I have
yeah.
a choice now. I can be quiet and pay attention to my meditation, or I can leave. But I cannot sit here and keep agonizing over the fact that they're hitting each other.
Right.
So I decided, since I'd travel 5,000 miles, I would see what else there was there. And not that I ever approved of the hitting, but I also recognized something else, that as a person from another culture, this is kind of like army boot camp or a football training. It's not something
yeah.
I can really, you know, the boys are kind of rough with each other. And for me to stand up and say this is intolerable wouldn't mean anything to them. They wanted to go through the same training that their ancestors had gone through, and this was somehow was like a rite of passage for them in their Zen training. And so this was something that mattered to them. They didn't want me to stop it. So even if I could have stopped it, that wasn't what it was about for them. So
yeah.
that took a lot of my working with. I don't approve of that kind of training. On the other hand, I had to decide whether there was something that I would come to understand by being there in this authentic Zen training experience in Japan. Because my feeling about what's happening in the West was that some authentic Japanese masters came over and tried to teach us what they did in Japan. And then when they died, we were left with something which we thought was what they did in Japan. But it was just, it wasn't a first-hand experience. So
right.
I wanted to have first-hand experience. And after having the first-hand experience of what is it like for your mind to open up in Zen training under these circumstances, I came to understand the kind of spiritual awakening they were aiming for, and came back determined to find culturally appropriate methods for achieving the same kind of spiritual awakening.
Ah, and did you find those methods?
Well, we'll have to ask my students in another series to see how many of them became enlightened. But here's what I decided to work with. You know, I am a psychologist.
Right, right.
And I felt that what they were aiming for was breaking down the attachment to the body. And the way they were breaking
right.
down the attachment to the body was through these beatings, through the sleep deprivation. Well, your body is the primary thing that you cling to and that you take pride in. So if you
yeah.
let go
yeah.
of your attachment to that, something happens. But I felt like, well, it's impossible for us to ask that of Westerners. First of all, we won't be able to do it without being sued. And
right.
second of all, it's just not part of our culture, this kind of samurai rough
training. Right.
But that there is something that we're very attached to, and that is our pride. We're very attached to our pride and all the games that we run. And so as a psychologist, what I work on with my students is uncovering their psychological defense mechanisms, and I think there's a lot of pain there.
Oh,
so
yeah.
rather than physically, I try to help them see the ways that they play games psychologically to build themselves up when
yeah.
they're fearful
yeah.
and try to help them pull those off in a way that they can use
right.
and encounter the pain that's underneath. And so that's basically how I work. I work with traditional Zen methods of periods of meditation, and I put less emphasis on some of the ritualized parts of Zen, which
right.
we do at large centers, and more emphasis on the interpersonal realm and the intrapsychic realm, where people are playing some kind of mind games.
Oh, interesting. Well, it sounds like a much more comprehensive and humane approach to enlightenment. And after all, everything is evolving somehow. It may not appear that way to us at times, but you know,
right.
there is
rather
a time
than imitate, yeah, I think it's good that we evolve. I think it's not so good for us to imitate what our
right.
Asian teachers brought over.
Exactly, what was just because it worked then, you know.
Yeah,
and
for them in that culture. And so what I came to feel from my training in Japan was that I understood the feeling of practice in Japan. And so how could I create a similar feeling of difficulty and hardship and devotion to practice? So I do some of the ritualized trainings, and we do also sew our own robes. And each step, each stitch that we sew, we take refuge in the Buddha. So there are some things that we do that are part of the tradition, and there are other ways in which I relate to my students and we relate to each other as a community that are different.
Well, you know, I had a thought as you were talking about the beatings and so on and so forth and the purpose of them, and I had an image of people floating in the water tanks with body deprivation, where you are floating in a tank of water and you're, you know, that is something that I think is designed to do something similar, to kind of free the higher, more subtle bodies from the lower ones and the ego and the attachments.
Well, I think that's right. I think that's one method in one place where we can have the experience of liberation is in those sensory deprivation tanks. Of course, we don't want to spend our life in a sensory deprivation tank. So the whole point is, how do we take our experience from the sensory deprivation tank or from the meditation cushion, how do we take that experience of awareness back into our life and integrate it into this whole complex machinery that we're carrying around for survival? And I think that's the trick, and that's where I'm really working with people, is how do they notice, what is the feeling in their body when they start defending themselves and running their games on themselves and other people? What does that feel like, and how can their attention be awakened in that moment so they can choose to let go again? Because if we limit ourselves to the time we spend in a deprivation tank or on the meditation cushion, it's only so many hours a day. We need to be able to carry forth the uncovering and the awakening of awareness into our daily activities. You know, the Tibetans also have a similar something to the deprivation tank, which is called a dark retreat, where they don't see the light of day and they sit and do their meditation, you know, in a dark cave or something like that. I haven't done it yet, but I'm thinking that I might want to do that in my sauna one day. Have a dark retreat, close myself in a sauna, not turn on the heat, but just stay in there and see what that looks like. I think that these are very good training techniques, and the important thing for us as Westerners is, you know, people get injured trying to sit too long in a half lotus or full lotus. So there are other methods, like the sensory deprivation methods, and also doing dream yoga at night, where you call upon your awareness. I call upon my awareness every night before I go to sleep and ask that I may awaken to the dream that I'm creating in my mind. And I try to do that during the day as well.
Oh, that's a beautiful thought. That's a very helpful tool.
Wore out my knees doing these meditations for long periods of time, I thought, I have to find some things that, other methods that work for me and for other people.
Really, either that or get some strong knee pads.
I'm afraid it's the inner knee pads that are the problem. I was in Japan, I saw an abbot who was more than 100 years old, one of the head abbots of the largest training monastery at Ehime, still sat in a full lotus position. Unfortunately, they had to carry him in on a palanquin. He could no longer walk. Myself had made the decision to sit in whatever position I could sit in, but to continue walking. And I think that this is an important point.
Yes, yes, that seems like a practical application. Well, you know, the other thing that I'm thinking, too, is that this must be quite a difficult task for those who are following this path, who are, you know, having to work jobs in corporations, which is a patriarchal foundation, and which does not really honor the much of anything other than making money. That must be quite a difficult thing to work on ego and connecting with spirit.
Stay alive. Yeah, we have to stay alive in the culture, right?
I
think it's always been the case that people who have sought spiritual awakening as the primary function of being human. People who have thought that have always been swimming against the mainstream of fame and fortune of every culture. So
yes.
I don't think it's any different now than it was 2,500 years ago during the time of the Buddha, when his family wanted him to be a good king and he decided to be a spiritual leader instead.
In
both in today and then, you know, possessions and fame and wealth were always the biggest thing that mattered and always have been in every culture. So I think for us, if we recognize that our spiritual practice generally runs countercurrent to what people are advocating in the culture.
Yes.
And that's some comfort, and I think it's also important, and the work that I do with people is to help them integrate their spiritual awakening with their actual lives, because there's nothing wrong with making money. There is something wrong with feeling like you don't belong in an organization or feeling like it's a dog-eat-dog and that you have to be hateful towards your coworkers. That's not a good environment. But if you can create a positive environment in which you are successful and do something useful, I'm not talking about making weapons, I'm talking about doing something useful for humanity,
right.
And there's nothing wrong with succeeding and paying attention to how, no matter how you succeed, you never get enough. And that's that never getting enough feeling, whether you're on the meditation cushion, never getting enough enlightenment, or whether you're at your job, never getting enough promotions and never getting enough salary, you have the same feeling of striving and imbalance. And so it's that you're working on, and it doesn't matter how you work on it so much, as long as you're not harming others.
Right, right, of course. That's very nice. You mentioned Buddha and his parents. You know a little bit about, I don't know much about his mother, and his stepmother was a key to his development too, wasn't she? Can you tell us something about his, please.
Yes, well, his mother died within, I think maybe it was about a week after he was born, so he never really knew his mother. His stepmother, who was also his mother's sister, so she was his aunt, and she was his stepmother.
Okay.
She was also at time that she became his stepmother and took care of him as an infant. She was the second wife to the same man that her older sister had been married to. So this is a very complicated family dynamic. So she had her share of difficulty in that her sister and she shared the same husband.
Aye.
She was also, her husband, the Buddha's father, had a harem of women.
Oh.
Always kind of jealousy among women who are in that situation and are
right.
using their powers of seduction to ensure the survival of themselves
right.
and their young.
Right.
And she also was a witness to what happened to women when they were no longer attractive and were, nobody cared about them once they were done being in the harem. So they, were sort of human trash. So she was very sensitive to these issues. I don't know. There isn't much written about how she coached or taught the Buddha as his mother or stepmother or aunt. But there was. She was one of the first people that he met when he returned to his home village after his spiritual awakening. And she asked him, she was one of the first of his family members to ask him if she too could follow the same path. And so did his wife, who he abandoned. He abandoned his wife and newborn son when he went off on a spiritual journey. And so it was his wife and his stepmother who asked him for ordination. And because of the cultural complexity and the submissive position of women in the Hindu culture of the day, he said he could not do that. Now, it's not quite clear what happened. This was 2,500 years ago. It's possible that he did give them ordination, but did not allow them to leave home and to practice as homeless monks or nuns. And so the story goes that his stepmother, Mahaprajapati, his aunt, and stepmother, led a group of women on a walk of hundreds of miles until their feet were bloody. Following him, they shaved their heads, they put on the robes, and they joined him where he was with his monks and once more requested to leave home and become full-fledged members of the Buddhist community.
Wow.
And there is a passage that is recorded that probably isn't true, but it's fun for the story, which is his cousin, Ananda, said to him, you know, why is your stepmother crying? What's going on? He said, don't bother me with this, the Buddha said. Don't bug me with this. She's already asked me if women could be ordained, and I'm not going to allow it. And so the rule was in those days that you could ask three times. So his cousin Ananda asked him three times if he would ordain women, and when he refused for the third time, then he was not allowed to ask anymore. So he asked another question. And the other question was to the Buddha, can women attain the same liberation and enlightenment that men can? And the story we're told is the Buddha said, yes, they can, and okay, we'll admit them. We'll admit them. But they will always be submissive to the male order. And so this has been a problem for women in that they did select to be ordained, and the only condition that Mahaprajapati objected to was that the most senior nun would always be junior to the most junior monk. So she objected to this, but when the Buddha would not relent, supposedly he didn't, and we don't even know if he said this during his lifetime, but that's the way the Buddhist patriarchy has passed on this information. The Buddha said so, so women will never have equal status to men in Buddhist tradition. Now, this has been the case in the Theravadan tradition, the old style of Buddhism, in Southeast Asia, in Burma, in Thailand and various countries, but in fact, the women's order died out because it took 10 nuns and 10 monks to ordain a woman, and once there were no more nuns, they said, well, you can't get there from here. We can't ordain anymore. Now, what has happened recently is that Westerners have begun within the Thai tradition, Westerners who are highly placed in the Thai tradition, have begun to ordain women, and they've been excommunicated by the Buddhist authorities in Thailand, the teachers. So it's become quite an issue in our time. I never thought I would see it in my lifetime, that this order that has been lost of the old-style Buddhist nuns being revived, and people saying, well, guess what? Everything changes, and so we're ordaining women.
That's great.
Yeah, no, we've even had ordinations here in California.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and in Australia, in Perth, Australia. And some of the Buddhist teachers, even the Asian Buddhist teachers, are supporting it. But so far the authorities in that old style of Buddhism, Theravadan tradition, is not supporting it. In the Mahayana tradition, of which Zen is a part, the women have had a continuous lineage and have not, outside of Asia, have not observed the submissiveness to men. So particularly in the West, we see a very vibrant women's order with 50% of Buddhist teachers in the Mahayana and the Zen tradition and in the Pure Land tradition being women. In the Tibetan tradition, we still see that this is mostly dominated by men because it comes from Tibet, and the Tibetans are all reincarnated tulkus, and no woman in her right mind, nobody in their right mind wants to be reincarnated as a woman, so in Tibet. So these are all men that are pretty much, there are a few nuns, but they're the nuns' order never took root in Tibet. So we do have the nuns' order in Zen, and we are beginning to get it back in the old-style Theravadan Buddhism.
Well, now, if they believe in reincarnation, wouldn't they couldn't they conceive that they, as men, have been, in various other lifetimes, they had been incarnated as women?
Yeah, but they feel that that's a punishment.
Oh,
if you're really bad, you're coming back. It's really bad, you come back as a woman. That was the Hindu belief.
Oh, my.
And, being reborn as a woman is a definite no-no. And if go anywhere in the world and you see women and children living in poverty, you know it's not the best plan. I haven't figured out why I did it this lifetime, but, you know, I'm still working on that.
Yeah, interesting. Wow, the belief systems that hold up.
Yeah, it's a closed circuit.
Yes, exactly.
You can't get at it, and so,
yeah.
You know, they say, well, you know, when they find these tulkus, they're always men. Well, of course, because
right.
that's the way it is, and I myself. You know, believe that some of these teachers may come back, and it would be a real hardship for them if they came back as a woman in those cultures.
But think about the spiritual growth.
Yeah. Well, they have a lot of spiritual growth, but they wouldn't be able to offer their teaching. You know, the rules.
Well, yes, that's right. That's right. Someone would have to break through the mold and become another Buddha, only a female version of it, I suppose.
Yeah, she might or might not ever get any airtime.
right, exactly. Well, you know, even if Christ came back today, he'd probably be arrested and put to death again right away for his crazy belief, you know.
Yeah, they'd probably put him on antipsychotics first.
First, yes, exactly. And then maybe on the Oprah show, I don't know. but anyway, levity aside... When you did your research for the book about these various women, did you come across anything that surprised you or that you found particularly interesting that you'd like to share?
Well, I think the thing that surprised me most was when I put together a timeline, there wasn't ever a time when women weren't practicing and really offering some very deep teachings throughout these 2,500 years of Buddhism. So I was surprised. You know, when Zen first came to the West, you know, in the 50s and the 60s for the beatniks and the hippies, we never knew anything about the female tradition because in Asia, the teachers who came over from Japan had studied in Asia where men and women were segregated, and they didn't really know too many nuns, and they hadn't really been familiar with the nuns' practice. So I didn't even know there were any women, never mind that there was a continuous stream from the time of the Buddha through India, China, Korea, and Japan, and other countries in Vietnam, that women practiced and made large contributions to.
Mm. Well, in a way, it wouldn't be surprising because I've heard the same thing from... those who are scholars in the Egyptian research, and they talk about the female priestesses and the many years of peace that existed during that time, and the mystery schools and various tantric schools, and so on and so forth. And so there's always been a kind of an undercurrent or hidden female line that's kind of been a current underneath. And the men have, you know, been riding the waves and, you know, the heroes and the rest of it. But the real strong current that's holding it up has often been the female presence, the divine feminine.
Well, yes, there's the divine feminine. And then there's all the women who offered their worldly influence and support. The queens and the empresses in Asia, who were big supporters of Buddhist practice and built many temples, and the women of wealth and influence used their influence to support Buddhism. I think the most surprising story for me was the story of Tokeji Temple in Japan, which was started around the 13th century by women of the Shogun's family and imperial family of the emperor, and these women became ordained and abbesses and used all of their influence and power to rescue women who were in abusive marriages from their husbands. There was no legal recourse to divorce. So for 500 years when they're, for women. Men could get divorces, but women couldn't. And so women who were abandoned by their husbands had to find some way to survive, but it usually involved prostitution or something else. So
right.
These imperial nuns and very wealthy and influential women supported this temple of Tokeji for 500 years, provided sanctuary, and women who had no legal recourse to marriage, to divorce, and who had to stay in these marriages even when they were being beaten. If they could find their way, if they could sneak out of their home and get to Tokeji Temple, they could serve for 2 years as a nun and be legally divorced. And the temple had so much power because it was backed by both the shogunate and the emperor that even the most powerful of husbands could not get their wives out of the temple once they were in.
Wow.
It was an amazing situation, really an amazing situation. And that kind of knocked my socks off because that was the 13th century, the first women's shelter on the planet.
Wow. And that demonstrates the immense capacity for compassion and heart-centered action.
Yes, very much so. But coupled with the kind of practical intelligence, these women used all their relatives, of their family members, and they also hired, with their wealth, they hired bodyguards.
Wow, I love it.
So they were very resourceful.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
Yeah, they were very resourceful, and there are amazing stories from that temple, and I visited several times. It's really quite a powerful story of what women can do when they come together to support each other.
Oh, yes. I see that happening a lot more today, and I'm having more people on the show, too, that are focusing on this in their own areas of interest. So it's really encouraging to see that the patriarchy is not... It's in decline. Like
it's a nuisance. It's a nuisance, but it's not insurmountable.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, Zen is so that we don't get too confused about what it means. Everybody's got their own thoughts on it. Can you give us an example of what the essence of Zen teachings might be?
Well, the essence of Zen teaching is that the wisdom and our practice is based on meditation, so that there is a kind of awareness that we tune into in meditation that can be refined with discipline. And this is the heart of Zen practice. So it's not based on Buddhist scripture or any wordy discourses, although we do tend to talk a lot. But that the essence of Zen practice is actually in our seated meditation. Now, it takes a long time to deepen meditation practice sufficiently, and it takes a lot of instruction and work for the community. It's for people who are very patient and very committed to their spiritual development.
Mm-hmm.
But it is based entirely on the practice of meditation.
Okay. And... of course,
and that's what it means. Zen means meditation.
Ah, good. That's very helpful. That's very helpful. And it does seem that there's an intelligent, a kind of almost like a impish platonic dialogue that can occur between the master and the students, which is used to make the create the thought within the student to come to one's own answers.
Well, this is the men's way, you know, which is Jerry Seinfeld talks about it. You know, what are you thinking? Nothing. You know, he said, can I tell you what men are thinking? Nothing. So this kind of laconic style in Zen is very masculine. As I say, the women were far more articulate and gave very precise practice instructions, much more so. And so many of these short exchanges are between men, and they may be very satisfying to men and not so satisfying to women. So I have counts in my book of male teachers teaching women, and they show that the teaching relationship is just that. It's a relationship. It's based on personal communications back and forth, and that these magic words, even though sometimes they trigger something, occur in the context of a very deep relationship. Now, the deep relationship between men may be just shoving and grunting, but generally between women and women, or women and men, it's a little more elaborate. So there is the koan system, and it does suit men very well. Just as one of the practice rules when we're doing meditation retreats is that we don't make eye contact. Well, that works just fine for men. For example, male babies are not really that interested in mutual eye gazing, but female babies are. So there are things that women require in terms of relatedness in order to find their way in practice that are very nourishing for women that seem to be somewhat unnecessary for men in finding their way. So it's been one of the things I've been interested in exploring, is how to adapt Zen training to suit women a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like there's much room for development and evolution. Is there a place for humor in Zen?
Oh, very much so. It's always been the case. And one of the things I've noticed is that there's a lot of toilet humor, even historically. In China, 1,000 years ago, when someone said, what is a Buddha? And the teacher would say, a dried shit stick. So, you know, this is really a long traditional part of Zen, is humor.
Good. But we won't see any stand-up comedians in Zen probably for a while.
I've seen a few show up at meetings, but they are the rare bird. That's true.
Now you have a retreat that you live at. Actually, do you open that up to people who are interested in coming and?
Yes. I do, but I ask that people train with me at my more public groups where I give basic meditation instruction. I have groups in Modesto and in Fresno, and I meet at the Unitarian Church in Fresno. It's on Alluvial. And in Modesto, I meet at the Church of the Brethren. And so I have my groups there, and people do a little bit of training, and they learn how to do meditation, and they see if Zen appeals to them and that it doesn't drive them out of their minds first before we invite them to do a long retreat in a quieter setting. So that's how that works.
Well, good. And you also still do your therapy, because you are a therapist, right?
I'm a psychologist. I'm a clinical psychologist, but I haven't been seeing any patients. I keep my training active, and I keep my license active, but because I think it's useful in understanding how people think and what troubles them. So I keep my training active, but I don't see any patients any longer. So if people want to work with me in terms of Zen training, that's pretty much the technology that I teach right now in terms of working on your suffering. So they can go to my website, which is emptynestzendo.org or zenwomen.org to make a contact.
Wonderful. And that's emptynest.
Yes.
.org.
Emptynestzendo. It's a Buddhist joke.
Because Zendo.
The empty nest sounds like what we have at a certain age when our children leave home. We have the empty nest, but in Buddhism it sounds like emptiness. So it's empty nest. Zendo. Emptynestzendo.org. emptynestzendo.org, or simply zenwomen.org is another way to contact me.
Wonderful. And do you have is your email address there at those places?
Yeah, they can contact me through the website, and I also have a website in Modesto, modestozen.org.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, and of course, your book is available on your site and probably at the major bookstores, and it's called Zen Women, Beyond Tea Ladies, Iron Maidens, and Macho Masters, and I highly recommend it. And so we are coming to the end of the hour, and I want to thank you for being with us tonight. This is certainly opening up some doors for all of us, and you are shining so much light into this area of California that I don't know. I'll have to put my sunglasses on when I go out tomorrow.
Well, I don't want to shock you, but I think you can take it.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Well, you've been wonderful, and I thank you for being on the show, and you'll have to come back someday, and we'll talk some more about this stuff.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
All right. And thank you, everybody, for being with us tonight, and we will see you next week. Good night, everybody.
Hi, this is Marco May. I'm really happy you're enjoying BBSRadio.com.
Hi there, this is Christoph Goes. You'll be listening to new tracks from my new album Turning Inside right here on BBS Radio, because if it's not mainstream, it's on BBSRadio.com.